Okay, so hi everyone, welcome back to a new episode of the Quantum Gravity Seminar. Today it's a pleasure to have Sabri Das from the University of Lethbridge, and he's going to tell us about the quantum residue equation for implication for space-time singularities and the origin, the quantum origin of cosmological constant. So please, Sabri.
Okay. Thank you. First, I'd like to thank Daniel and the organizers Perimeter for giving the opportunity to talk here. It's much appreciated. The second point is, like, I mean, I haven't given too many Zoom talks, so excuse me if something goes wrong from my end. I'm happy to answer any questions, of course, at the end of the talk, but even in between, just like stop me. I'd probably not be able to see the audience, right, because I'll be focusing on the talk, but if you have any questions, just ask, and I'll try my best to answer. So I will. I've already shared the screen, I believe. I'm going to make it full screen. So, and if it doesn't work, like, maybe Daniel can let me know.
Yeah, try that.
I'll do that right away. Yeah, there you go. Thank you. The only other thing I need to do is like move the Zoom window on this very side. Okay, I'll start right away. And again, like I'll try to keep track of the time. It's past 12:30, and I'll try to stop at 45, 50 minutes. If I go too much over, just let me know. Okay, let's start. So I wanted to talk about the quantum Raichaudhuri equation, its implications for space-time singularities, and the quantum origin of lambda. So the plan of the talk is a bit on the Raichaudhuri equation and singularity theorems, and correspondingly, quantum Raichaudhuri equation and no singularity theorems, and how one can go to a quantum corrected Friedmann equation from the quantum Raichaudhuri equation, and then talk about what implications it can possibly have for dark matter and dark energy if dark matter is postulated to consist of a Bose-Einstein condensate at very low temperature, and summary and conclusions. The picture you see below is part of our university with the beautiful Canadian Rockies in the background. It's kind of like this today, except it's kind of windy. But anyway, Lethbridge is in Western Canada, Alberta. The nearest big city is Calgary, in case you're interested. Okay, so the Raichaudhuri equation and singularity theorems. Singularities in space-time. So we know that singularities are space-time pathologies which signal the breakdown of all of physics and also perhaps the start and end of time, for example, the Big Bang and Big Crunch. It's also a signature of black holes, for example. Now, often, like, curvature scalars blowing up is considered as a sign of singularity. While it is not wrong, however, it's at best it is indicative, but it's neither necessary nor a sufficient condition for singular space times. There are lots of reasons. There can be an infinite curvature in a space time, but it takes an infinite proper time to reach it. So no observer can ever reach it. So then we would hesitate to call it singular. On the other hand, we can have a perfectly regular space time where the curvature scalars never blows up, but one can cut out a hole from that space-time, and then one would deem that space-time as singular. So the only real criterion for the singularity of space-time is the so-called geodesic incompleteness, where in place of a geodesic going on forever in the past and the future, the geodesic kind of hits a dead end. Like the geodesic, it physically can be extended beyond a finite proper time, and that's a sure sign of singularity of space-time as it is imagined. And the Raichaudhuri equation is the paraphrasing someone, is that it's like the driving engine behind singularity theorem. So no Raichaudhuri equation, no singularity theorems. Okay, and the Raichaudhuri equation, as it starts off, is purely a statement of geometry, although one can incorporate the Einstein equation in it, as we shall show, but it's the derivation is pretty simple. So what we have here is a congruence of geodesics, a pencil of geodesics, and UA is the velocity field, so the tangent vector to every geodesic in this whole space-time. We take the covariant derivative and then take the derivative with respect to time. This can be written as this thing. Here it's an identity. Change the order of the covariant derivative, a curvature tensor, Riemann tensor gets picked up, which is this. Simplify it. There is this geodesic equation plus these two extra terms. We assume they're geodesic, so this part is zero. So we have this extra term here and this term here. And as I said, let me proceed for a second. And so this is the parent equation or identity, if you like, deriving the Reichelder equation. Now this velocity field, the derivative thereof, which is UAB semicolon, the symmetric part without the trace we call sigma, the anti-symmetric part we call omega, and the trace we call theta. And so this velocity field can be decomposed into the symmetric traceless, the symmetric part, the symmetric traceless part, the trace, and the anti-symmetric part. And if you take the trace of that equation, what we end up with is the Reichelder equation. Again, it's a statement in geometry, unless or until we replace this R with TTACD, then it becomes a statement incorporating the Einstein equation. The point is that there will always be geodesics for which the omega, which is essentially like the rotation, is zero, for which the right-hand side is all negative. And if theta, which is the rate of convergence of geodesics, one can think of it that way, if that rate is finite at some initial time, then within a finite proper time, the theta goes to minus infinity. One can simply integrate this equation. The theta, the expansion, tends to minus infinity, which means that the geodesics converge, like they converge into a focus, in a finite past and in a finite future, right? So the geodesics end at a point. So that's the crucial key result. And as I said, like it's pretty simple, as we can see here. This is the whole derivation. Now, why is that important? It's important, and I'll try to argue for a Riemannian manifold because it's here, but then it holds good for pseudo-Riemannian manifold. So a Riemannian manifold, let's say like a with plus 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 signature surface of the Earth, if you have points A and B along a great circle, now the shortest distance does not have any conjugate points, right? For this great circle, the conjugate points where all the geodesics converge at the north and the south pole, they don't form part of this A to B great circle, right? If they did, then the geodesic would be not the shortest path, but then like that geodesic would be the longest path. So for pseudo-Riemannian manifolds, it's the other way around. So we saw that due to the Reichelder equation, there is always conjugate points. And if the conjugate points are, if you have these two conjugate points, as they are always the case, then the geodesics in the same vein, it can be shown that they are no longer maximal length curves. However, from global arguments, one can argue that from global arguments that maximal geodesics curves do exist. So there is a contradiction between the two, and the only way that the contradiction can be resolved when one has conjugate points is the statement that sufficiently long geodesics cannot exist or geodesics are incomplete, and therefore, by definition, when geodesics are incomplete, there are singularities as per the singularity theorem. So this is the essence of the singularity theorems. And as we saw, it crucially depends on the Reichelder equation. And it holds for all spacetimes. Let's just say most spacetimes. And this was derived like almost kind of simultaneously around the same time by Reichelder and independently by Landau and Lifshitz. And the singularity theorems, the famous, as we know, are by Penrose and Hawking in a series of papers. So this was the Reichelder equation, and this is Reichelder, and this is Landau and Lifshitz. And as I said, the derivation is there in Reichelder's papers. It's also there almost as clearly in Landau and Lifshitz classic textbook. I forget which version, 1950 something version of the text. So a couple of points, and I'm kind of looking at my clock so that I don't run over time. So a few points, important ones. So it's like, first is its generality. So Reichelder equation is very general, and the reason is gravitation is universal and gravitational attractive, right? So all reasonable spacetimes are singular, and physics breaks down because gravity is attractive and universal. The second point is one uses the fluid picture, the velocity field, let's just say, of geodesics, U of X, which we used. However, everything is classical, of course, right? The space-time is classical, the geodesics are classical, the particles are classical, everything that we did was classical. So of course, the natural question arises, what happens when we do a quantum version of it? For example, one could look at expectation values, Ehrenfest-type theorems, or any other quantum correction, and there could be many ways or many, you know, types of quantum correction, absolutely. But it's a question one, like, you know, it's an immediate question one asks. So how do we try to get a quantum version of it? First, we, like, again, the way I proceed is find, instead of a classical velocity field, find a quantum velocity field, okay? Now, quantum velocity field, it kind of may sound a bit funny because, you know, what are velocities there? Like, you know, how do you define velocities as a field, as not as an operator? Fortunately, there exists such a formalism. Now, before that, just for simplicity, we'll do everything in all details in curved space times. But for simplicity and to demonstrate the physics as best as I can, we look at this so-called non-relativistic version of the Reichhauser equation. Again, just as I said, just to try to bring out the physics. So the Reichhauser equation is this, right? And as I mentioned, there's an extra term here, which is the geodesic equation, which we set it to zero because they're geodesics. Now, for simplicity, look at the non-relativistic version where the R gets replaced by R times U gets replaced by the Poisson, like the Navier square V classical, where classical V is the classical potential, gravitational potential, Newtonian potential. And then, right, the Reichhauser equation looks almost the same as this, except tau, instead of tau, we have T, and instead of this R term, we have this Poisson equation term. And instead of the geodesic equation, what we have here is simply the Newton's law, right? It's Newton's second law, which is zero. So one question, the question we ask is, how does this term here, okay, get changed under quantization? And later, we will, like, generalize and ask how the geodesic equation gets changed. But let's just do non-relativistic Newtonian to begin with, okay? So this is Newton's law, right? So when we go from classical to quantum, non-relativistic, again, just for simplicity to start off with, the Newton's law, second law, is replaced by the Schrödinger equation, as we know. The wave function we write as two fields, R and S, the amplitude and the phase, they're both real fields, real function. And then following, just as done in the Hamilton Jacobi theory in classical mechanics, we define the velocity field, or the velocity, dx dt, as the imaginary part of gradient of psi over psi times h bar over m, which is also simply the gradient of this function s. Now this is real, these are real, so the velocity field is real. Now this is one can call this as a quantum velocity field, and again in the classical limit it goes down to the classical velocity field. So it's a reasonable thing to do, it's the natural thing to do. Now put this in, like put this, plug this in decomposition in the Schrödinger equation, take the real and imaginary parts of the Schrödinger equation. Interestingly enough, the real part simply gives the conservation law, as we know, where rho is psi square, and v is this velocity defined in this way. I should have written rho as psi square, it's kind of the standard anyway. And interestingly enough, the imaginary part of the Schrödinger equation, as you can see here, looks exactly like Newton's law with this extra term here, right? And this extra term here, like, you know, what's inside the gradient with a minus sign, is known as the quantum potential. So essentially, what happens when we quantize is we get back Newton's equation with an extra quantum potential term, which depends on the wave function, because R is part of the, this curly R, is calligraphic R, is part of the wave function. Now, so a few things here. One is, like, it's proportional to h bar. So taking the classical limit is trivial, just set h bar to zero. And this VQ here is the quantum potential. Now, a few points before we proceed. So the two equations here that we have, this equation and the conservation equation, guarantees that if initially the particles are distributed according to, say, psi zero square, right, then probability conservation ensures that they remain distributed as rho equals psi t square. So which basically means that the equations ensure that the probability interpretation of the wave function is valid at all times, if you start off with that interpretation. And each particle trajectory now follows these so-called quantile trajectories or Bohmian trajectories, but now subject to not just the classical potential, but classical plus quantum potential, and make a measurement in the end, and all predictions of quantum mechanics arrived at in a standard way are all, they're all valid. For example, I give an example and I have the reference and everything here. So if you look at the Young's double slit experiment, so there are two slits, let's say electrons are distributed here according to some initial Gaussian distribution. And if they are evolved according to the full equation, okay, I'm not going back, but it's like the classical potential, which could be zero in this case, or there could be a trap, classical trap, so that the particles don't go out. And the quantum potential, which we derive depends on the wave function, then, interestingly, if one evolves, one gets exactly the fringe patterns here, okay? Like the results are exactly the same. And it can be shown again, and I think it was shown in this paper and lots of other works, where if somebody had H-bar tuning machine, let's just say, if H-bar was tuned to zero, then the fringe patterns would disappear and one would get pretty much like two bright spots. Okay, so again, the classical limit is very transparent here. And just the points to note is all correct quantum predictions, it's a different interpretation. The results are all the same. The only dynamical input is probably an obvious statement, but just to kind of, it's the only dynamical input is the Schrödinger equation, no more, no less. The classical limit is very transparent. It was de Broglie, Bohm, and lots of, people after, researchers after them who studied this. It's used quite extensively, actually, in superconductivity, superfluidity, Bose-Einstein condensate, Gross-Pitevsky equation. So it's actually used a lot in many fields because it's useful. And note that the quantum potential, interestingly, one can show, and I'm not going to prove it here, but one can show that for stationary states, interestingly enough, the quantum potential is essentially the negative of the classical potential plus a constant, if the wave function is a stationary state, and this depends on the wave function. And this is something which will have implications for, later in the talk. And this formulation, which is, again, it's perfectly equivalent to the standard formulation, was two key players in the beginning were, de Broglie and Bohm. Now, let's come back to the Reichert equation. Let's come back to the non-relativistic Newtonian version of the Reichert equation for whatever it's worth. And this is this. And I mentioned that this part was set to zero because this is Newton's law. But now Newton's law, this part is not zero. Now one has the quantum potential here. So therefore one puts this instead of zero or instead of this quantity here, V dot plus gradient of V classical, one substitutes the quantum potential here, and we have the quantum Reichert equation, but a non-relativistic version thereof. So it's quantum, but it's, I guess, in the C going to infinity limit. But even there, we see that this sign is plus, okay? So there is hope that this extra term will create a repulsion. And in fact, I should perhaps go back here. If you see this picture here for the Young's double slit experiment, it's exactly this short distance repulsion due to the quantum potential which creates these fringes, okay? So when the trajectories are very close by, just the quantum potential dictates that there's a short distance repulsion, as you can see in this picture. But it's not just that picture, it's a generic feature. But I just wanted to point out that there's a plus sign here, so there is hope. Now, we have to do this is a good motivation and all, but we have to do the relativistic version. So instead of classical fluid, we now derive the quantum fluid description, but not for Schrodinger equation, of course. We look at the relativistic equation, which naturally, should be taken, which is the Klein-Gordon equation. So this is like the generalization. And we do the same kind of decomposition. So, as one can see, like with the non-relativistic derivation behind us, the derivation is easier to understand. So the wave function, once again, we write it as amplitude and phase, so two real fields. And instead of velocity, now we define the momentum. Again, the same Hamilton-Jacobi formulation as a gradient of this phase field S, and the U is k over m times h bar as usual. So this is the velocity. We take the imaginary part of the Klein-Gordon equation. We get this equation, which is a conservation equation, again, that one gets in normal quantum mechanics. The real part of the Klein-Gordon equation is interesting. It's this, okay, when we do this decomposition and we take a derivative, we see interestingly that the real part is now the geodesic equation, but with the extra force on the right hand side. So the geodesic equation, they're no longer geodesics. So the quantum counterparts of the geodesics, which are the quantum trajectories, don't follow a geodesic equation. They follow, it's as if there's a quantum force on the right hand side. Okay, and again, this goes to zero, which h bar goes to zero. So therefore, wherever we had the geodesic equation, the Reichhofer equation, instead of setting it to zero, we should put in here. So to remind, in the derivation of the Reichhofer equation, we set this term to zero, okay? Instead of the geodesic equation setting to zero, we put in the relativistic version of the quantum potential here, and then take the trace and do all that kind of stuff. And Right. So when we do that, when we put this in, now the Reichhofer equation acquires this extra quantum correction term. So we call this the quantum Reichhofer equation. And here we have this, you know, this apparent repulsive term here. Okay. Now, so one may be able to argue that because of the repulsive term there, the geodesics, all the quantum trajectories, the quantum equivalents, they don't they don't actually come and form conjugate points. The argument is actually stronger than that. Just like, you know, one can put in various forms of reasonable wave functions and see that that's exactly what's happening. And I did that. But the argument is actually stronger. And we'll come to it in a moment. We just kind of say that this is the plus term, it's wave function dependent, and the quantum term prevents focusing and formation of conjugate points. But the argument, as I said, is stronger because the reason is, although this looks like the quantum version of the geodesic equation looks very similar to the geodesic equation with an extra term, the quantum version of Newton's law looks very similar to the Newton's law with an extra term, but there's a fundamental difference, which is that the velocity being defined as this, it's essentially the evolution is governed by a first order equation as opposed to a second order equation, which is Newton's law, right? What this means is that since the velocity field, since S, the phase field S is unique, like single valued everywhere and unique, the velocity field here is also unique, which means the integral curves never intersect, because if they intersect, then the velocity will be ambiguous at that point. So from here, one can clearly see that these quantum trajectories, they will not form conjugate points either in the future or in the past. I'm not sure why I wrote this. I should say not geodesics, but the quantum trajectory should go on forever. So that's kind of it should be quantum trajectories. So they should go on forever. And therefore, as far as this quantum trajectory is concerned, there are no, like the singularity theorems don't hold good. So there are no singularities in this particular sense that these trajectories, this quantum trajectories go on forever. I don't know if there's a question. If there is, please feel
free. Yeah, I have a question
for you.
So I agree with this argument, but I want to point out that the equivalence of the fluid picture with quantum mechanics of the Breuboom is not exactly true. That is, at some point you made an assumption that the wave function is globally defined. In terms of the fluid picture, you made the assumption that the vorticity vanished. Now, this is the reason, that's what you were saying. Because the vorticity vanished, the velocity field is a pure gradient, and therefore the trajectory do not intersect. But in fact, there's many configurations in quantum mechanics which corresponds to a fluid that carries some vorticity. And in that case, you know, this argument doesn't follow through. So it's often forgotten that the Breuboom is not equivalent to quantum mechanics. It's only equivalent to a subset of quantum mechanics that assumes that there's no vorticity.
Okay, that's a very good point, yes. Now, so
if we define the velocity field as gradient of S, then of course, by definition, there is no vorticity, right?
Yeah.
And so there could be points where it's that field S is ambiguous, in those particular points, it may break down. But even in the classical Raichaudhuri equation, you see, like, we assume that there exists a class of geodesics for which omega equals zero, and for them, you have the singularity theorems, right?
That's kind of a related question. How strong is that assumption? Like, is that, so in some sense, you know, because in some sense, you could avoid classically the, it's kind of related.
If you allow vorticity
in your trajectory. So how effective is that assumption that all the trajectories...
Very good question. Yeah. We could have a whole discussion on that, but that's a great question. So the way I said is, it's the way that it's normally stated, that you have a class of geodesics. So there exists a class of geodesics for which the singularity theorems hold, and for which you have conjugate points and, you know, geodesic end, right? So, and that's kind of enough to prove the theorems. And here also we look at the corresponding quantum trajectories. Okay, so there exists a set of quantum trajectories and a large class, if I may say so, for which the vorticity is zero and whatever I said is valid. So these are like the exact counterparts of this quantum. But when you have vorticity, so there are various ways that, you know, one has tried to avoid singularities in the classical context, and vorticity was certainly something which one did consider. But yeah, we can discuss this again. It's my screen, and again, I'm like Zoom and all. It's kind of a little bit new to me, so I can't see you. So may I know who?
I'm here. No, you should.
I can't see you though.
It's Laurent.
Ah, Laurent. Okay.
You can't see me. You should be. I don't know. I'm here. I can see.
Okay, let me see. Okay, I'll see you in the end. But nice to meet you, Laurent. See you, Laurent, yes. After a long time. Thank you for your question. Okay, so let me proceed. Okay. So, and again, I mean, it's the H bar which comes into the picture. Following up on Laurent's question, and it's, I think it's relevant, is that, yes, two things, even classically or semi-classically, I guess, one can try to find repulsive terms in the Raichaudhuri equation, even before, you know, the quantum Raichaudhuri equation, before what I did. And second is, like, there could be other sources, right? For example, string theory, loop quantum gravity, and Said, myself, we have been exploring ways of there can be, you know, repulsive terms in loop quantum gravity, for example. In string theory, there has been a lot of attempts. So those terms, of course, are there. I'm looking at a very particular quantum addition to the Raichaudhuri equation with a purpose in mind, of course, and there could be others as well. But if I may say so, like, one of the strengths here is pretty general, so it's not tied down to a particular formalism, and this first order argument is pretty strong. And this argument of no crossing of quantum trajectories, I mean, I'm using it here, but it's nothing to do with the Raichaudhuri equation per se. This was known, I mean, from the beginning, and has been used and, you know, demonstrated with several examples, potentials, and all those kind of things. So it's the generality, I guess. So, and its application. So anyway, so coming back to this, whenever something changes in the Raichaudhuri equation, something must change in the Friedmann equation. Okay, the reason is, of course, is straightforward. Like, if you start with the FLRW, the Friedmann, Robertson, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker universe, where A is the scale factor, we just assume the scale factor is one now, then one can derive directly from, say, the Raichaudhuri to the Friedmann equation. So the expansion theta needs to be identified. And remember, like, Friedmann equation is all about fluids. So this picture is, I mean, it's very natural that the Raichaudhuri fluid picture holds good and can be applied there. So three times what? Log derivative of the scale factor, that's the expansion. And one replaces the R by the density and pressure, as one usually does, normally does, I mean, always does. And one gets the Friedmann equation. Interestingly, I mean, I'm sure, like, the derivations were done by many, many people. But interestingly enough, in Raichaudhuri's book, I mean, this is the first page of the book, he himself does the derivation, right? And it's where I saw it one very early on, so I just thought I'll put a picture up there. So anyway, so this is the Friedman derivation. So therefore, if something changes here, something must change here. Okay, so let's just see how it changes. So we make this identification. And again, this is the FLRW universe, like this. And if we replace the Ray Chaudhuri equation with the Ray Chaudhuri equation plus the quantum term, in the quantum, well, we call it the quantum Friedman equation. In the Friedman equation, one gets this extra term here, which is this. And this extra term is h bar squared. These corrections are always h bar squared. H is the induced metric, and box is, R is the amplitude of the wave function. So the point is that it's a wave function dependent correction, as we saw before. And we just call it lambda, okay? So if we call it lambda, of course, with a purpose in mind, that my question is whether it can be identified with a cosmological constant or whether it can give rise to a constant, right? So we don't know yet, but let me just call it whatever. Let me call it lambda and Q for quantum. It's wave function dependent. And consequences for the quantum Ray Chaudhuri equation with this, velocity fields. And again, if you have vorticity, I'm not thinking, I mean, following up on the question, with vorticity, it gets even better because the the convergence properties get worse with vorticity. So that's good. So in any way, so the no crossing slash no intersecting property of quantum geodesics obviously translates in the cosmological context to when those trajectories were very close together, so Big Bang or Big Crunch or something like that. So the quantum trajectories will not cross. Okay, but so that's one aspect. How am I doing with time? Okay, and the other aspect is, like, let's study the quantum version of the Friedman equation itself, which is this thing here, right? And let's see if this term here can give rise to a cosmological constant. So I'm in the company of experts, so I don't want to talk too much about this, and we mostly be redundant, but this is like a lightning review of the current problem, some of the problems. And I mean, this is the supernova data. There are lots of hundreds of other data at this point of time. But anyway, the conclusions remain the same, which is, like, if he plots a luminosity distance versus redshift, the curve is not straight. It turns here. And a consequence, I mean, the most important consequence is that this can only be satisfied if you have about 70% of dark energy with the equation of state, which is E over rho equals minus one. And out of the remaining 30%, it's 25% dark matter and 5% visible matter. So that's established beyond any reasonable doubt, I believe. But the questions remain, which is, of course, what constitutes dark matter? There's lots of very good candidates, and yet I don't think like one can say that this is dark matter, one or the other, right now. What constitutes lambda, or dark energy, as sometimes it's called if it's evolving? Why is lambda positive? It's a very small number. In the next line, as we see, it's about 10 power minus 123, 124 in Planck units. It's a very small number. So why is lambda positive? Why is lambda tiny? But there's also another question, right? Which is, at this epoch, or when the redshift is not that huge, the densities of dark matter and dark energy, or density of dark matter and the corresponding density of cosmological constant, which is this, they're approximately the same, and almost the same as the critical density of the universe, okay? Critical density is h squared over g. So if you take the ratios of, take like 3:2, any ratio of any to anything else, the ratio is always one. I mean, one or half or two, like order of one, okay? And this number, they're all about almost the same, which is about 10 power minus 26 in SI units. This is known as the so-called coincidence problem. So there is no reason, and again, it's an expert audience, so I didn't go into all the formulas, but we know that rho lambda remains constant, whereas rho dark matter decays as 1 over a cubed, right? So it's kind of it's a coincidence that they're the same, right? So let's see if we can say something about it. Now, we propose that Bose-Einstein condensate, there's a Bose-Einstein condensate of light bosons, very light bosons, which form dark energy. So which is a dark matter candidate, okay? And the reasons behind it is one, well, Bose-Einstein condensate is cold, just as dark matter is. Bose-Einstein condensate is dark, just as dark matter is. Light bosons as dark matter. So if you have light bosons, there would be no, you know, small scale structure as we see in nature. The Bose-Einstein condensate is a macroscopic state, but it's a quantum state, and that's important. So Bose-Einstein condensate is one of the very few quantum states which are quantum as well as macroscopic, right? Like a magnet. And the Bose-Einstein condensate, since it's a quantum state with a wave function, it will have a quantum potential associated with it, whether we like it or not. And if it has that, then it will be repulsive, and there is some hope of getting there's a hope of you know, a positive cosmological constant from it. So in brief, like, we can see that there are very few assumptions and a very few parameters, okay? And the only parameter for a Bose-Einstein condensate is its mass of the constituent bosons. So let's just first see if a Bose-Einstein condensate can actually form in this universe, okay? So the relevant question is the critical temperature of these bosons below which a Bose-Einstein condensate forms, is it high enough? Is it high enough compared to the temperature of the universe that there is indeed a Bose-Einstein condensate? And I should mention something, I think, at the very outset, that Bose-Einstein condensate as dark matter or dark matter as Bose-Einstein condensate, we are not the first. Lots of authors who considered that and, you know, did all kinds of study and lots of evidence in its favor and that kind of thing. But we were first, or one of the first at least, who explored the quantum potential and the, you know, quantum force which comes associated with it. So Bose-Einstein condensate as dark matter, I don't claim that you were the first, but the quantum potential, we were one of the first, or, you know, Anyway, so let's calculate the critical temperature TC, compare it with the universe temperature TA, it's a function of scale factor, with the boson mass M in electron volts, dark matter, we assume it's to be like roughly 1/4 critical density and it decays as 1/8 cubed, and the number density of boson N over V, therefore, is this divided by the mass of the bosons, okay? And this is a well-known result for relativistic bosons, that the critical temperature is essentially up to factors like Riemann zeta and stuff, like it's essentially the number density power 1/3. And this is a rigorous way of proving. There's also an easy way of arguing it. And if anyone's interested, I can talk later about. So it's when the thermal de Broglie wavelength exceeds the intermolecular interparticle spacing. And you can get it from there too. In any case, if you put in all the numbers, we see that if M is in electron volts, this is the critical temperature. The temperature of the universe, at least for the redshifts, which are not that large, is essentially it's the CMBR over A. And if we compare, interestingly, see, both go as 1/A. So if the inequality, this is satisfied at one time, it's satisfied forever, okay? And indeed, if we impose this inequality that the critical temperature exceeds the universe temperature, it's satisfied for M less than a few electron volts, okay? So for any, so the upshot, the conclusion is, that if one has bosonic mass or light bosons of mass of a few electron volts or lower, then a Bose-Einstein condensate is bound to form, okay? We have to have those bosons. And so that's the only assumption. So as far as I can see, there are no other free parameters in the theory. So the assumption that the density of the Bose-Einstein condensate is dark, well, that's an assumption, right? So now let's calculate the quantum potential. Now, so Bose-Einstein condensate, like a magnet, it comes like a coherent macroscopic wave function. And in this case, it will stretch over cosmological length scales. I will justify in a few minutes, but let's just assume that consistent with the observed homogeneity and isotropy, large scale, very accurately observed or found homogeneity and isotropy of the universe, let's assume that the wave function is a Gaussian of this form, where R is a co-moving radius from anywhere, like you measure from anywhere, any point in the universe at any given time. And sigma is the width of the Gaussian. We'll find it later what it is. And so this is important, right? Because everything, the quantum potential depends on the wave function. So this wave function is crucial. I mean, the quantum potential crucially depends on the wave function. And this is what we assume. R0 is a constant. Let's not, I mean, I will not confuse with the calligraphic R, which was that wave function like itself. This is just a constant, like a number, R0. And the square of it is the square of it is the density. So the integral of it is the total number of bosons in the universe or whatever, like the Bose-Einstein condensate. And I have this factor a power 3 halves. This takes care of the dark matter decay goes as 1 over a cube. Okay, so this takes care of that. And then if I write the quantum Friedman equation with lambda q as I defined earlier, indeed, and it's easy to check, I mean, you're welcome to check, that if you put this wave function in this expression here, it indeed turns out to be a constant, okay? And this constant is of this form, forget the 24, it's essentially 1 over m squared sigma power 4, where sigma is the width of the Gaussian. So what is the width of the Gaussian? So to estimate the width of the Gaussian, we go back to Newtonian cosmology, right? Non-relativistic cosmology, and as is justified. So we go to the Newtonian limit, and it's justified because as observed, the space-time curvature is zero. No, the spatial curvature is zero. The space-time curvature is very small. It's 10 to the power minus 24. So it's almost, it's virtually, it's practically flat space, right? So then if you assume a sphere of radius R cut out anywhere from, you know, and of course this R is like 300 megaparsecs or whatever, so large scale. Then if you have a test mass at the surface of the sphere, and you can cut it off anywhere at any given time. Sorry. Then the mass, this mass m is influenced only by the mass that's inside the sphere, which we know. And for the density of the sphere, we assume it to be the critical density as observed. And then we put it in here in Newton's law. We see that for times which are not that large, in which we can, you know, the expansion of the sphere due to the expansion of the universe is not as large compared to the time scale defined by the critical density. The equation, this is Newtonian cosmology, right? So the Friedman equation is obtained if we substitute R as some scale R naught times the scale factor, because the radius R grows as the scale factor linearly. Epsilon is the fraction of, yeah, it's 0.25 because of reasons stated earlier. We see that indeed, it looks like for those time scales, it looks like a simple harmonic equation with a constant omega. So therefore the ground state, it indeed a Gaussian with these values here, okay? And so the omega is, I'm not like spelling out the details here, the omega is like this whole thing here, square root of that, okay? So the whole thing that you have in top, so g 4 third pi, the r cancels, epsilon rho critical, power half, okay? So if you put that, so the sigma square is square root of omega, so we get this, and therefore the value of sigma is completely determined. Whatever is written here, I can see because some zoom messages coming out here, but is there, rho critical, and I don't know, it's a factor of three or something there. So this is sigma, and recall that if the wave function was Gaussian, the extra term was a constant. Now we know what the width of the Gaussian is, which is this. So put this back in here, and we find that if you put it in here, we find that that extra term here is exactly equal to the critical temperature, well, the critical density here, okay? And if we calculate rho lambda, which is the density corresponding to lambda, right, this is divided by 4 pi g, we see that this is again proportional to rho critical. Therefore, the density of dark matter, we assumed it to be rho critical times epsilon, the density of dark energy is twice that, so the ratio is 2. The ratio, what should the ratio be? The ratio should be 3, but you know, we get 2, which is, I mean, close enough, I guess. It's in the same order of magnitude. And we'll see why we get this, of course, but before that, just one quick digression, if you like. So we assumed that the scale factor, it was evolving slowly, okay? Now slow compared to what? That's the question, right? So to answer that question, we decompose the scale factor into a constant part plus a time varying part, okay? Slowly varying, well, slowly, that's the question, how slow is slow. So the wave function also we can decompose into this. So everything, like the amplitude of the wave function, we can decompose as a time dependent plus a slowly varying part. Similarly, so whatever lambda we got, we get the constant term, which is what I've written down in next page. And there's also a slowly varying part, which I've not written down here. I've calculated it. It's pretty complicated. And one can try to find a meaning out of it. But yeah, so there is a time dependent part, right? But the point is that the leading part is a constant plus a slowly varying part. How slow is slow? Well, we assume that this part here is small compared to the leading part here, just like a Taylor expansion approximation is much, much less than one. And we can assume different kinds of scale factors. So matter or radiation or De Sitter, and one can do the calculations. And what we get is this time here, which is the reference time. So this is the time in the past where we do this, you know, this expansion here. So the final, you know, the upshot is that whatever for matter or radiation or whatever, the current time, which is T, minus the reference time, okay, this time difference must be much less than the reference time minus, let's say, the starting time, the Big Bang, or, you know, somewhere near that, right? So long as this is satisfied, that the difference between the current time and the reference time is much less than the reference time minus the starting time, okay, this approximation is valid. And therefore, this approximation is valid. And therefore, this approximation is valid. So when those approximation is valid, we do get the quantum potential induced cosmological constant term, the density thereof to be approximately equal to the density of dark matter, as we had assumed. So that's the main result. So I'll summarize. So the question was, like some of the questions were, what constitutes dark matter? We postulate that it's a large Bose-Einstein condensate made up of light bosons. What constitutes dark energy? Well, we see that at least the quantum potential from the Bose-Einstein condensate gives rise to a cosmological constant. There could be other sources, absolutely. But we do find a source of the cosmological constant here, which is purely, so if we assume there's a BEC, there is a wave function. If there's a wave function, there's a lambda. If there's, well, there's an extra term. If the wave function is Gaussian, as we argued from going to the classic, well, non-relativistic limit, then it's a constant. So that's kind of line of argument. Why is lambda positive? Well, the main reason is because I should, at the risk of, well, running over time, well, I should not, at the risk of being confusing, but let me kind of go back to just one early slide, and I hope, yeah. So see, the quantum potential, so this is a consequence of the fact that for stationary state, for example, the Gaussian ground state of the harmonic oscillator, the quantum potential is negative of the classical potential, right? So what is the plus a constant. Now, what is the classical potential in this case? The classical potential in this case is the gravitational potential, which is negative, right? And therefore, it's not a surprise, no wonder, that the quantum potential is positive. So in this case, the positivity comes out because we started with the gravitational potential, which is universally negative. And why are all the densities equal or approximately equal? Because the quantum potential is equal to the classical potential, you know, in terms of magnitude for stationary states. Now, we got rho lambda to be of the order of dark matter, like rho dark matter. We didn't get 3, it's approximately 3, right? Like 70 over 25, whatever, 2.8, whatever it is. Now, there are lots of corrections, right? For one thing, let's keep in mind that the dark matter, like whenever, like let's say dark matter equals twice dark energy or half or whatever, half, I guess. Like the dark matter starts decaying immediately, right? As 1 over a cubed, whereas rho lambda does not decay. So even if you measure a little later, this wouldn't be, you know, like the dark energy would, the ratio of dark energy, like ratio of lambda to dark matter would keep increasing. So this ratio is like, you know, so it's not surprising that we don't get exactly 3. And there are other effects too. And another important point actually is that we assume that all the bosons are in the ground state, which it is not. And there's a precise formula, precise way of calculating how many bosons in an ensemble, like in a Bose-Einstein condensate are in the ground state. It's a function of temperature. It's 1 minus T over T c power 3 or something of that nature. One can do an exact calculation, and we have done some estimates, and it does increase the value of, like it does increase the ratio of lambda to dark matter. It does. So that's, I believe, so that's another reason why, you know, we get something which is not exactly what's observed, but of the same order of magnitude. A prediction of this model is, of course, we have we must have an ultralight bosons for less than 6 electron volts. There are lots of candidates, right? Axions, there could be gravitons, there could be some ultralight axions, bosons, but we don't know what exactly it is, and that's more work needs to be done. So they must be there. We could do an interacting dark, so we assume that the dark matter part and dark energy part are separate. However, they could interact, right? And that interaction could also contribute to a change in the density. This is some work which I've been doing with Sharma and Sur, and hopefully we'll have something in the near future, but it's work in progress. And do you have another prediction? Again, I can't read the last line because of Zoom, but another prediction is that the where we estimated for how much time, you know, our approximation is valid, clearly it's not valid forever. Clearly, if this inequality is not valid, then it's not valid. Well, then our calculations will cease to hold good. So clearly, at some point in the past, it must break down, right? And our interpretation is that this kind of says that the lambda must have changed, if this model is correct, must have changed sometime in the far past. And that's something which is worth studying and worth estimating. So that's where I'll end. And I'm very happy to take questions. I'll just see if I can see the audience. I think it's my doing that. Yeah, okay. I can see the audience. And so thanks. Thank you very much for your attention. And I'm here for questions. So.
All right, let's thank speaker again. So yeah, we have a good 15 minutes for questions. If
I don't know. anyone can ask, or if Daniel would like to conduct, whichever way. I'm just trying.
Whoever wants to ask again.
Absolutely. So I can't see everyone in the same because it's like I need to go back and forth. So whenever I hear something, I'll answer. So.
Well, I can start. I'm curious about what do you think it would be a promising candidate as light boson? Because so the model you are presenting seems very flexible in the sense that you have this quantum potential and the precise characteristics of the quantum potential then would, I suppose, depend on the specific boson that is making up this condensate. So the question would be also, how would this scenario change if you have a different kind of particle?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I state upfront that as I try to kind of explain that, I don't know what these bosons are, right? I mean, so it depends. So they just have to be less than a few electron volts. So one of the candidates, there has been lots of arguments, as I'm sure we are familiar with, is like if the bosons of the order of, say, 10 power, I forget, minus 26 or something like that, 26 in what? Electron volts, I suppose. Then there's lots of advantages. There's no subgalactic structure formation and stuff like that. So that's included in this, okay? So, however, as I said, like our model makes an assumption. So any bosons would work, and we would have to find, you know, more structure, I guess, more interactions and see, then try to, you know, pinpoint or narrow down the range. I mean, our range is good, but maybe it's too big, right? We may have to narrow it down. One comment I'd like to make, and thanks again for your question, is like, let's see. Yeah, you can see my slides, can you?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, thank you. So if you look at this last line here, okay, let me go one back. So here, the lambda q depends on this m square sigma and all that kind of thing. And I can go into the details, or, you know, if you have any questions, I can answer later and I can send the detail or whatever. But if you look at here in the end, what we have as the lambda, the m cancels, okay? So that's could be a good thing, could be a bad thing, but in the end, it just depends on the critical density up to, you know. So the m does not it gets cancelled in the end. And I think it's a good thing. So yeah, so so the long story short is, we need to pinpoint or further constrain the range of the boson mass.
And if I can just follow up with another question, can you remind me what is exactly that is constraining the mass to be few electron volts?
Absolutely. So it's the first calculation. It's like, if we don't have the critical temperature higher than the temperature of the lab, then there's no Bose-Einstein condensate.
I see.
So we calculate the critical temperature, and as you can see here, the critical temperature for relativistic bosons essentially goes as 1/3 power of the density. And since we assume the density, we identify with the dark matter density, we get this. So, and the dark matter density decays as 1/8. That's how I have this 1/A here. And we just assume it's less than, you know, the CMBR temperature.
Okay. So this is because, this is a constraint in order to have the model. So it's not a constraint coming from observation. It's more a constraint to have your model, to start to build up your model.
Absolutely. That's the base Einstein, that's to have a Bose-Einstein condense. In my defense, it's a huge range. So the constraint is not a very kind of odd or awkward constraint. But you're absolutely right. It's an absolute, so we need it to form a Bose-Einstein condense. No two ways about it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
There is a question from Hank Chan. Please go ahead and ask the question.
Hey, hello.
Hi.
I'm just wondering if we can start from, instead of Klein-Gordon, maybe we can consider fermions and start from Dirac's equation, get the quantum potential using there, and then think about the Bose-Einstein condensate as a condensate of Cooper pairs, right? Can we also do something like that?
Absolutely. So when you just said Dirac equation, I was thinking like bosons, but yeah, it could have Cooper pairs. Yeah, I don't think anybody has, not to my knowledge. Maybe in other statistical mechanics, they might have seen Cooper pair, Bose-Einstein condensate of Cooper pairs, but I can't recall right now.
Right.
But absolutely. But can I, well, thanks for your question. Can I ask like, why would you be interested in it? And I mean it in a kind of serious way. Like it sounds very interesting, but why would you think that might be like that might bring something in new?
I'm actually not sure because my background is in condensed matter and not cosmology. So, and I used to do some theoretical stuff with superconductors. So just wondering if there are any implications, like for example, if dark matter is superconducting, then what that would mean for, you know, cosmology as a whole, just wondering something like that.
Somewhat related to Francesca's questions, right? Like we don't know what the nature of these bosons. So the bosons can be composite, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no reason to believe that the bosons are fundamental. And if they're composite, then Cooper pairs is a natural candidate. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so thanks for the question. And if you're interested, we can talk later. Yeah,
thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So we have time for a few more questions. If anyone in the audience wants to ask. So if not, I'll have to ask one question. Have you thought how to apply this to black holes as well?
Thought about it, but I've not done anything. But so the quantum Raichaudhuri equation, the repulsive term can be studied near the singularity of a black hole. It's I did think about it. It's just a matter of time. I mean, it's a time constraint that didn't.
You would also consider a Bose-Einstein condensate in that case, or?
One would need, one would need something with a wave function. So the Bose-Einstein condensate is a good example. Not necessarily though, because even if you have, let's say, a bunch of, you know, particles which are kind of converging into towards the black hole singularity. And if they can be described by a wave function, then yeah, there would be a quantum potential. It doesn't have to be a Bose-Einstein quantum set. So it can be, but it doesn't have to be. One needs a wave function, of course. And then the question is, whether it will be repulsive enough to avoid singularities. I'll give you what I know, which is like, before going into the generalities, like when we found out this term, we're trying all kinds of wave functions, okay? Like just ad hoc. So ad hoc wave functions, so solutions of the Gross-Pitevsky equation for small interactions, the wave functions are sometimes hyperbolic, sometimes depending on the sign and all, Gaussian. So what I can say with confidence is I calculated that quantum potential term in the Rh-Hauser equation, and all the wave functions that I took and calculated are all repulsive, okay, so at short distances. So there is strong hope, I would say, but you know, one has to work it out in the background of a Schwarzschild black hole and see that those results hold good.
Finn, there is a question from Ding. If you want to go on and ask the question.
Hi, Sarja.
Oh, hi, Ding. Hi.
So the question is short. Is there a second quantized picture behind the formalism?
Okay. So the second quantized formalism, I believe there are certain interpretational issues with it. For example, second quantization, of course, like the trajectory scan, like quantum trajectories can end, right? Because there can be pair creation and that kind of thing, right? But you still have like, let's say one photon, you know, like or two photons, whatever, giving rise to two quantum trajectories of two electrons. So it can be done. I'm not an expert on that, but I think it does exist. And yeah, further corrections might possibly appear from there. And in that kind of note, like, I didn't want to like go too much into it because the causal interpretation of this Bohmian or de Broglie Bohm, the trajectories can become light, but I don't like, we don't measure anywhere in between. So this is just a picture, and all we're interested in getting results out of it. So if a so-called physical interpretation can be given, cannot be given at all times for the trajectories, I'm not that bothered, so to speak, because we're interested in using it as a tool and it all gives the identical results. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the kind of.
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes, Francesca, I guess.
If there are no other questions from people who have not spoken before, but.
I think you can go on.
Okay. I wanted to ask about the effective cosmological constant that you get. So you have the possibility of a varying cosmological constant. And I was worrying how much variation do you expect going back in the early universe, and I wonder if you have started to evaluate the compatibility with observations with constraint from data.
No, that's what I'd like to do. So right now with some collaborators, we are just doing like the preliminary data fitting with the Lambda CDM model. It's working, but you know, the paper, as soon as we have the paper, but the other part, no, we have not. But there are two reasons for which it should happen. One is like our approximations must break down at some point. So some change must happen. And as I tried to show, I mean, it's kind of related, it's not independent, but just like, you know, doing that analysis, we do see that, again, I can't see the end, but we do see that lambda, there is a constant term, there is a time varying term. So there absolutely, there is, and there should be. Yeah, no, I've not done the data. That's part of the, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, you expect something small, I suppose, especially.
Something small. A small variation of the cosmological constant. Now that's kind of a small variation of the cosmological constant, to my understanding, is not inconsistent with data, right? But which means, Okay.
No, it's not inconsistent. So there is always a question whether you don't want too much because otherwise it would be inconsistent. Mm-hmm. So a small variation is permitted, but then if it is too slow, then too little, then you may don't have access to the precision to see this variation. So.
So that's something which that's definitely the right thing to try to do, and I'd like to do it as soon as I can.
Okay, so other questions?
Anyone can ask questions later on, send me an email or whatever. Like, I'm happy to answer at any point of time. So thank you.
Okay, so let's sing sorry again.